I just didn't think it could take up the whole town to get it.
Galena residents rebuild and navigate government bureaucracy as winter approaches. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, UAF researchers study walrus DNA to help predict how the species will fare in the future.
This otherwise seemingly worthless material is actually a gold mine of information, and what we're going to be getting out of it is just the tip of the iceberg.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A spokeswoman for Governor Sean Parnell says the white substance that prompted the evacuation and closure of the state office building in Juneau this morning has been deemed non-hazardous. Sharon Lehouse says the FBI made the determination after contacting the California pharmaceutical company that sent the package. She says the company was sending tax documents to the State Department of Revenue, and the shipping material apparently came apart when the package was opened, prompting the scare. She says she did not have the name of the company. She says the building will be reopened. Capital City Fire and Rescue ordered the entire building evacuated shortly after 10 a.m. It's been more than 4 months since a spring breakup flood ravaged Galena. A lot of progress has been made to repair damaged infrastructure from power and water lines to roads and public buildings. More than 50 homes have been fixed or rebuilt, but many others remain in disrepair. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, some Galena residents have struggled to navigate a tangle of assistance programs.
Jen Hildebrand's home was one of the most photographed in Galena this spring. Already in rough shape, the house sat immersed in a flood-formed lake for weeks.
I always prayed to God for a new house. I just didn't think it was going to take out the whole town to get it.
Hildebrand happily watches as a forklift swings trusses into place on her new house. The small three-bedroom, designed by the Fairbanks-based Cold Climate Housing Research Center, sits atop a high mound of gravel and steel pilings.
So you're going to be high and dry, you think, no matter what?
I'm going to see that next flood coming on that river.
The new house will also be super energy efficient, a village dream home. But Hildebrand, like many Galena residents, had to negotiate a web of bureaucracy and programs to finance it.
There's always a catch. If you're eligible, you got to do this, you got to do that, but then you can't get this. Yeah, I had to fight for it. We all did.
Crying for you yesterday.
Oh, no more crying.
No.
Neighbor Frida Beasley checks in on the progress, happy for her friend and sad about her own situation.
It was a frustrating summer, battling with the insurance company, with FEMA and SBA, and the misunderstanding and how well you have to read between the lines, you know, and how frustrating it is to get all those phone calls of a rejection. Right at the very first meeting, FEMA told us all of us were going to get, you know, almost like $32,000.
Beasley says an income cap and flood insurance disqualified she and her husband from getting the government payout. They're using insurance money and a bank loan to rebuild, but complications have delayed the project until next summer. So like many, they're staying in a relative's home.
There are people that are couch surfing.
Carl Edwards heads up flood recovery for the state of Alaska.
A lot of people prefer to stay with relatives than be in a shelter or somewhere else. And we're trying to help them all.
Edwards acknowledges some people have fallen through the cracks.
Unfortunately, that is true.
But he points to the success stories, knowing winter is bringing the rebuilding season to an end.
We have got some people back into their homes. We do have some homes completed. We have about a week left of large teams here in Galena working. So they're trying to wrap up as much as they can before they leave. And the goal or the hope is that they can at least get shells on houses so that people can do inside work through the winter.
Edwards credits numerous volunteer crews from faith-based organizations who have helped people rebuild. The state, FEMA, Salvation Army, AmeriCorps, and other government and tribal organizations also provide food, clothing, and temporary housing. Local teacher Adriana Hevesy was a renter who lost her place in the flood and is one of 20 or so living at a shelter.
I have a job. This is home to me. So why should I move? You know, my son is graduating this year. I mean, this is his home. This, you know, his friends are here. I mean, so we're trying to stay.
Hevesy doesn't blame the government for some people's struggle to recover from the flood.
I don't expect the government to give me anything. So whatever I got, I was thankful. You know, it was unfortunate what happened. Things happen in life. You know, you just have to be resilient and do the best you can.
Hevesy has purchased a heavily damaged home with plans to rebuild it. That kind of self-reliance is taken to the extreme in another Galena housing project.
Absolutely zero help of any sort.
Jake Pogrebinski is aiding friend Gilbert Huntington put together a log cabin, a labor-intensive endeavor pursued without any government assistance. The locally cut wood shines bright from hours of work using machinery the men cobbled back together after the flood.
Everything we used was drowned out. This forklift has drowned. The mill that we used to mill the logs has drowned. This is why we're both staggering, you know, with exhaustion.
Pogrebinski says he'll get to fixing up his own place next summer, a plan many Galena residents have not adopted by choice. In Galena, I'm Dan Bross.
The electric utility trying to buy out Bethel Utilities Corporation says they are still on schedule for a spring takeover. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Mira Kohler, president of the Alaska Villages Electric Cooperative, says the buyout would cut electric rates for BUC's customers in Bethel, Nabuskiak, and Oscarville. And the co-op's other 52 villages should experience the benefit as well.
We expect those savings actually to show across the AVEC system.
AVEC is a nonprofit electric cooperative serving Western Alaska. BUC is a for-profit company, and therein lies the savings, says Kohler. She says AVEC's cost structure is different than BUC's.
They're a tax-paying entity, so included in their rate base is a component that goes to the federal government to pay income taxes, corporate income taxes. We don't have to do that, so that comes right out of the rate base.
AVEC expects Bethel's rates to be 8 to 10% lower immediately. There will also be more options for customers paying their bills.
We're going to be accepting credit cards for payment. And once everybody is fully integrated into our system, you will be able to go online and look at your account online, pay your bill online, do all sorts of things that you can't do at this particular point in time.
AVEC plans to keep the diesel-generated power plant in Bethel, which Kohler says is well-run by competent staff. And they'll keep the same office building in the downtown area. BUC and AVEC jointly filed in July to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska for an approval of the transfer. Kohler says if all goes well, VRCA will rule on the transfer by December 12th.
Then we will start the process of all the various things that need to happen to transfer the utility completely to us. And we anticipate taking over operation of BUC on May 1st of next year.
AVEC's long-term plan includes looking for funding sources to improve the equipment at the power plant and eventually seek wind power integration to reduce their dependency on fuel. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The president and chief executive officer of Sea Alaska Corporation has announced his retirement. The corporation today says Chris E. McNeil Jr. will retire within the next 9 months after a successor has been named. Since 2001, McNeil has been the head of the Juneau-based Alaska Native Regional Corporation, which has more than 21,000 Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian tribal member shareholders. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a float down Alaska's scenic Tikchik River in the country's largest state park.
Every turn of the river opened up a new vista, a new view, a new mountain, a new ridge. You can't get tired of it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A volcano on the Alaska Peninsula has again become active during a months-long eruption, with a trace of ash falling on communities up to 35 miles away. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says in a release that Vinyamina Volcano resumed its 2013 eruption on Saturday after being quiet for about a month. It's been marked by lava flows, fountaining, and intermittent but small ash, steam, and gas plumes. The plumes usually only travel a few miles from the volcano, but the communities of Chignik Lake and Chignik Lagoon, about 35 miles away, reported trace ash today. The observatory says ash fall from the volcano 480 miles southwest of Anchorage is not considered to be significant. The eruption started in June. Researchers at the University of Alaska Fairbanks will spend the next 4 years studying various aspects of Pacific walruses in the far north. The $1.7 million project is funded by the National Science Foundation. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
In a lab in the basement of the Museum of the North, three scientists brainstorm over how best to make use of a set of walrus teeth.
So these teeth are full of DNA.
That's Link Olson. He's the curator of mammals at the museum. He's holding a bag of golf ball-sized yellow teeth. Some of them are marked with rust-colored rings.
That's blood. That's residual tissue that can be used to get DNA from, even if we aren't able to drill into the teeth. So this otherwise seemingly worthless material is actually a gold mine of information, and what we're going to be getting out of it is just the tip of the iceberg.
Olson is part of a larger research team that was recently awarded a $1.7 million grant from the National Science Foundation. For his part, he'll use DNA sequencing technology to piece together the genetic story of the Pacific walrus over the last 2,000 years.
Foremost in my mind is whether or not these are able to adapt evolutionarily quickly enough to some of the changes they're facing.
Walrus habitat has declined in recent years due to changes in sea ice extent. That's why lead researcher Nicole Mazzardi says the project is timely.
There are a lot of villages on the northwestern coast and northern coast that rely on walrus for food all winter long. They rely on the ivory to bring in money from carvings and artwork. So it's important as far as the sustainability of villages are concerned. And so that's one level of it. And the other level of it is they're a good species to look at as the Arctic changes.
The team will look at everything from walrus habitat to genetics, and they'll use thousands of available samples to answer their questions. They'll also use archived interviews to learn more about traditional knowledge of the Pacific walrus. It's the largest study of its kind. Mazzardi says it also spans a time period longer than any other marine mammal study.
If we can push this back, you know, the 2,000 or 3,000 years, we're hitting other time periods that were also much warmer than things have been for the last few hundred years. And so if sea ice was receding then, we might see some changes as well. So, and it probably did recede then because the medieval warm was a fairly warm time period.
Some of the changes scientists hope to discover could be hidden in walrus bones. Laura Horstman is an assistant professor at UAF's School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. She plans to extract hormones from ancient and modern bone specimens.
Cortisol is a stress response hormone, and so this is something that we could get at look at stress response in the past and today and see if that has changed. So are animals today more stressed than they were 2,000 years ago?
Horstman's work involves methods that have never been used in marine mammal research.
Well, it's fairly new in the forensic world, so where people have tried that, and at this point in time, we don't even know if it's going to work. So this is highly experimental.
If it does work, she says the data will provide a wealth of information. A number of Alaska Native organizations will participate in the study. The funding will also pay for two student research positions at UAF and 4 Alaska Native high school students will take part in 2016. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
The University of Alaska Anchorage's hockey team is putting its turbulent off-season behind it, and with a new athletic director and head coach at the helm, the team has an opportunity to take advantage of a clean slate of sorts. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The team is practicing at the Sullivan Arena this week, preparing for their first big tournament of the season. The forwards and defensemen start off with some passing and skating drills to get their blood flowing, and new head hockey coach Matt Thomas is firing pucks on net to help the goalies loosen up. There's a lot of pressure on a new coach when they take over a team. Some of it's from the fans, some from the players and staff, and according to Coach Thomas, a lot of it comes from himself.
I embrace that pressure. It's why I'm in this business. It's why I coach. I've got gray hair to prove it. I've got enough stress, and I need to get. I should be getting massages weekly because of the stresses in the shoulders and the neck, but I wouldn't want it any other way.
Thomas is taking over a team that hasn't had a winning season in this millennium, and he recognizes that it can be a tough trend to break. But he wants the players and staff to improve every day and recognize what their strengths are so they can take advantage of them.
I think you coach based on the players you have and the type of team you have. And right now we've got a team of very committed, hardworking players that if we play a good team game, I think it gives us a chance to win every night.
And with a shaken up Western Collegiate Hockey Association, which features 6 new teams, including UAA's in-state rivals, the University of Alaska Fairbanks Nanooks, there should be plenty of opportunities to win. Thomas says the makeup of the old conference put programs like UAA's that didn't have the resources of the larger programs at a disadvantage. But he thinks the conference's new look will level the playing field.
I think you're going to see a very competitive conference where every team is truly committed each night and has a strong belief that they can win.
Not all of Thomas's duties are on the ice. He and his staff have been busy all summer working to bring in new recruits. And they have had some success, but not necessarily with the top Alaskan prospects, because they want to play somewhere else.
Right now, the program needs to get to a higher level of winning and tradition and really bring a lot of pride to the young kids that when they grow up, they want to be a part of this program. And I think right now that's not the case.
Thomas says having the team become more involved with youth hockey programs in the area will be a big step in fixing that problem.
Looking towards the future, it's something that we're certainly looking to do because we want all the talent that is in Alaska. We want it all to stay right here in Anchorage and be a part of UAA hockey.
Coach Thomas and the rest of the Seawolves are hosting the 2013 Kendall Hockey Classic this weekend in Anchorage, where they will face off against Air Force and Quinnipiac. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Thousands of Alaskans have already gone through a home or commercial energy audit. These programs can identify ways to save a third on energy costs. For more energy and cost-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, float. Woodtick-Chick State Park is the largest state park in the United States. With no road or trails, it remains a quiet preserve for the fish and wildlife it was created to protect. The Tick-Chick River winds a gentle 60 miles through the pristine northernmost regions of the park, and every few years, the park rangers float the river to get a better feel for what makes the area so unique. KDLG's Dave Benninger joined them on a trip this past summer and has this story.
Large and lonely at the north end of the Woodtick-Chick State Park sits Nishlik Lake, a fine place to begin a float of the Tick-Chick River. 4 of us camped 2 nights there, catching lake trout from the shore and finding big old grayling in a small unnamed lake a short hike away. For Chief Ranger Bill Burkon, this is the best the job gets.
We don't get up here very often. By airplane a few times a year to do some work, but a lot of it is maintaining that familiarity with the park. You know, we need to stay in touch with what's going on out here, and you can't do that sitting in front of a computer waiting for the phone to ring.
Part of staying in touch with the park, believe it or not, is what the ranger staff calls test fishing. And about a mile or so into our float of the Tick-Chick River, the fishing gets good. Real good.
Well, we are on the Tick-Chick River. The crystal clear water in a pool with numerous 17-inch grayling. I don't think it gets any better than this.
Big, beautiful grayling, some bright silver with shimmering turquoise, others a cool burnt umber, are astoundingly abundant in the Tick-Chick. We find them in every pool around every bend of the river.
Beautiful. Big dorsal. 18 inches. There he goes.
Just a few miles from Nishlik Lake, the first few crimson-red sockeye streak by.
There's reds right over here. Look at them all.
Right to your, right behind you, Dave.
Oh, look at them all over there.
Look at that pocket back there under those trees.
That's Allison Eskelin, the park's only other ranger. We count sockeye by the dozen, then by the hundreds, and soon we're drifting over thousands. Eskelin surprised to see so many this far upriver.
The most breathtaking thing is, you know, floating downriver and seeing these just pockets of crimson red salmon, all schooled up together, you know, waiting to spawn and take their place in the ecosystem. For the health of the river, for the health of the population, for the subsistence that all the people use those fish for, and having them, you know, that far up into the system, how many miles have they traveled to get up there?
You might need a map to put perspective on the incredible journey these salmon have undertaken so far. Up the Nooshigak, left on the Nuyukuk, past the falls, across the lake, and on up the Tick-Chick to their final destinations. We continue our test fishing, casting behind the sockeye and reeling in one grayling after the next. Passing through an unnamed canyon, we stop to watch a nesting pair of peregrine falcons agitated by our presence.
Are these a common occurrence out here?
These are the only two that I know of in the park.
How did you know they were here?
Well, they were here the last time we came through a couple of years ago.
Each evening on the Tick-Chick, it's easy to find a suitable gravel bar for camp, usually pre-stacked with driftwood for the fire. The further downriver we travel, the thicker the mosquitoes seem to be, but the fire helps.
Mosquitoes are biting me through like three layers of clothing.
We keep three or four grayling a day for dinner. What was the best grayling recipe?
I think the apple jalapeno with some of those ground cashews on top.
The one with apples, jalapenos, and onions over a bed of rice.
Best recipe was the crushed cashews with panko breadcrumbs and potato buds.
The last to answer there was Matt Wedeking, a ranger from Chugach State Park, who was impressed by his first trip to Wood Tick-Chick.
Unspoiled Alaskan wilderness. And it should stay that way. Alaska State Park should do what they can to keep that the way it is. The opportunity that this park provides is something that has to be kept and conserved for others, and so I can take my kids out here.
The scenery on the Tick-Chick float is striking. The sprawling high alpine tundras hemmed in by mountains, the lower pine forests woven with creeks and streams. Ranger Bill Burkon says he never tires of the visual experience alone.
Part of why this park was set aside is because of its outstanding scenic resources. Those are the words that are used in the management plan. And I haven't been let down on it. Every turn of the river opened up a new vista, a new view, a new mountain, a new ridge. You can't get tired of it.
A week passes on the Tick-Chick and we don't encounter a soul. Not a boat or plane, not even a jet crosses our sky. The pace is easy, the fish and wildlife are abundant. This is Alaska wilderness at its best, and it's hard to leave it behind. For AK, I'm Dave Benninger.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the community of Kenny Lake on the edge of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park.
My name is Vicki Kelzer, and I'm one of the co-owners of the Kenny Lake Mercantile, an RV park. We sell unleaded diesel, propane. We have laundry, showers, a diner that's closed for this year. It'll be open in the spring of 2014. Kenny Lake is a farming community. There's about 355 people, approximately. We have, I think, 89 or 92 students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Mostly hay. And then there's, you know, the smaller gardens. But some of those, what I consider small gardens, is probably an acre property. And they grow potatoes and carrots and celery and lettuce and turnips and red beets and cauliflower, cabbages. It's very quiet, serene, peaceful, beautiful. You come down the 7 Mile Hill, which we call, everyone here calls the 7 Mile Hill, which is the new Edgerton Highway. And as you're looking out on a beautiful, clear day, you see the Wrangell Mountains and you say, wow. If you don't get the wow factor, you're not in Kenny Lake. They snow machine, cross-country ski, hike, bike. There's quite a few hiking trails around here. You can walk from the Edgerton Highway down to the Tontina River, or you can go north on the other side of the Edgerton Highway and hike up to or down to the Copper River. Got lots of wildlife, bears, moose, foxes. Just saw a little red fox run across the road just up the road from where I'm at today. Beautiful red fox. There's moose that kind of wander around, and then, of course, we have the black bear and the grizzly bear.
Vicki Kozler is co-owner of the Kenny Lake Mercantile. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Benninger and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from across the state. I'm Annie Feit. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Galena, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.